Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 113, The Planets. Well, we do live on one and have plundered it fairly mercilessly, but of course, there are seven others out there. So, what's the plan?
Dear Cheap Astronomy, if we did colonize the solar system, what would we do on the different planets? Well, it remains to be seen if we will colonize the solar system. While we might manage to divert a mass extinction asteroid from hitting Earth, a supervolcano could just as easily end civilization as we know it. There's also the more mundane scenario of where our population keeps growing, we start running low on resources, and then fight a whole lot of wars over what's left, pretty much trashing what's left of the ecosystem in the process. But okay, let's be optimistic that none of these things will happen, and we will expand our range across the solar system. How we will get to that point is hard to predict, but some basic principles should prevail. The most important of those principles is that we'll go where the money is. It's just daft to think that anyone is going to foot a multi-billion dollar budget to establish and maintain an off-world colony just for the heck of it. Nor could the tenants afford the rent without there being a vibrant space economy working in the background. It's certainly conceivable that in the coming decades, various countries will establish bases on the moon, much as we see in Antarctica now. Once one country settles, then others follow, just to make sure they can get a piece of the action as soon as anyone figures out what the action is. For Antarctica, the main action is the noble pursuit of science, although no doubt there's a bit of fossil fuel and mineral prospecting going on as well. So we could expect that moon bases will follow the same model, with a fly-in, fly-out workforce, doing month or year-long stints there, ostensibly for science, but with an eye out for other opportunities. However, the cost of maintaining a lunar base will be some orders of magnitude more than an Antarctic base, so there'll be more pressure on governments to achieve some kind of return on investment, which is likely to result in those governments opening up opportunities to private industry. As we've discussed before, tourism and mining are the obvious opportunities to open up. Once you've got tourists coming to the moon on a regular basis, you could then start looking at trips further afield, since it's a lot easier to launch from the moon than from Earth. As for mining, regular listeners will be aware that we think the moon will be the future center of asteroid mining, where it makes more sense to bring the rocks to the refinery than take the refinery to the rocks. So we'll be crashing lots of on the moon and then sorting through the rubble, presumably on the far side of the moon, away from the tourists. And if crashing on the moon works out, then crashing on Mars will take things to a whole new level, since Mars is next to the asteroid belt. And being that much further away from Earth, it's more likely that people are going to stay on Mars for years, if not decades, so the prospect of having children and growing old on another planet may then become a reality. Of course, there are other places you could live in the solar system, potentially anywhere if you're willing to invest in the energy costs of maintaining a habitat. But that is essentially the point. Economics will determine where we go and what we do. So while you could live on a balloon floating in the clouds of Venus, and while you could live on Pluto with enough central heating, it's not clear what you could do in an economically useful sense in either location. A holiday in the Venusian clouds would be a holiday in a dense and toxic fog, while Pluto would be pretty much a holiday in the dark, although there might be just enough light to make out the interesting shapes of nitrogen ice formations. And if tourism isn't a goer, it's hard to see what else would draw people or industry to such places in the short term. But in the long term, our industrial endeavours might expand to what's expected from a Kardashev Type 1 civilization. A Type 1 civilization has undergone a range of technological advances that gives it access to orders of magnitude more energy than is currently available to us. And hence that advanced civilization will have much more capacity to exploit resources across the solar system. And since we've just raised this whole new perspective so late in the episode, you probably already guessed that all that will be the subject of part two.
This is the middle bit.
It has been more than 50 years since we've been back to the moon, but we're still telling ourselves that in the future we'll have lots of magical technologies which will make it all so much easier and routine. And maybe that's true, but of course, this is Cheap Astronomy.
Dear Cheap Astronomy, if we colonised the solar system, what would we do on the different planets? Part 2. In this Part 2 episode, we are looking into the far future, which has access to speculative technologies which may or may not come to pass. Indeed, as we stated in Part 1, we may never get beyond leaving a few footprints on our local satellite before civilization as we know it collapses completely. However, if we do assume the rise of technology can be kept on its current trajectory indefinitely, then sure, all sorts of things could become possible. But this is Cheap Astronomy, so we do have to lay out some wet blankets. Firstly, warp drive just isn't going to happen. And any speed that even approaches light speed is A, going to require an absolute ton of energy, and B, would be insanely dangerous with respect to collisions with small particles, let alone big particles. If we could manage just 1% of the speed of light, that's still an insanely fast 11 million kilometres an hour. At that speed, you could get to Pluto in around 23 days, although we should call it 30 days, since you'll need survivable periods of acceleration and deceleration at either end of the journey. However, given that we're dealing with advanced technologies, it remains to be seen whether taking over the solar system actually requires us to be all over the solar system. Alongside developing the future capacity to fly at insanely fast speeds, we should also see some major advances in robotics, including telepresence. That is, the ability to see and touch the things that your robot sees and touches. So with all that going for you, why put your own life at risk if you can just send a robot? While light-time radio delay eliminates the possibility of real-time decision-making, artificial intelligence and robot redundancy would work nearly as well. In other words, if one robot makes a mistake, you just tell the next one to follow a different algorithm. Anyway, whether it's us pulling the levers or the robots doing it for us, these are the sorts of things we could be doing on the different planets. On Mercury, you have an abundance of solar energy and some good mining prospects, with any non-organic mineral deposits that are available on Earth being also available there. Mining-wise, the same goes for Mars. And although Venus's surface is pretty inaccessible, its dense atmosphere represents a great source of CO2, useful for photosynthetic food production, or you could just electrolyze it for the oxygen, or you could combine it with H2O to make methane, if we are still doing mundane chemical rocketry in our far future. As for water, well, there's a bit on the moon and a bit more on Mars, and maybe a lot more in the outer asteroid belt past the frost line. There's also lots of water on the ice moons of the gas giants, along with an abundance of hydrogen available from the gas giants themselves. Even further out, there's a Kuiper belt full of ice blocks, although the further out you go, the more it's just empty space. But let's remember, this is cheap astronomy, where just because something could happen doesn't mean it will happen. Regardless of the seemingly magical transformations that future technologies may bring, the basic principles of return on investment will still apply. So, for example, no one's going to be sucking CO2 out of Venus's atmosphere unless there's a genuine need for it, and unless the benefit outweighs the cost of gaining that benefit. And while everyone gets excited about finding water in space, we've got more water than we know what to do with here on Earth. The only reason we'll need water in space is if we live in space. And to do that, we need a reason, an economic reason. So, getting back to basics, it's likely our next short-term step is to start sourcing rare earth metals from near-Earth asteroids. This will require a refinery and probably a permanent human presence on the moon, where we'll first crash and then refine asteroid ore. If we can manage that much, then you have a good rationale to start sourcing off-world water for those lunar bases. After that, it's all pretty much science fiction, until we really have managed these first next steps. Fingers crossed.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. Space is hard, and it's expensive, and so the road ahead is not clear. There are certainly more resources out there in the solar system, but accessing them, let alone achieving a return on investment from them, still looks a long way off. But let's remember, back in 1957, it's unlikely that anyone envisioned those first beeps from Sputnik 1 would lead to worldwide satellite broadcasting and GPS, not to mention the International Space Station. So there are certainly grounds for taking a few leaps of faith here. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you just want to start making moonshine rocket fuel, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll prime the pumps for you. Thanks for listening. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.